Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 204, Nightmares as a Tool for Personal Growth with Ann Hill. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
And I think, you know, us versus them is a really interesting theme to look at in dreams, because it can be a picture of our own warring impulses. I mean, I guess that's where I go first. Is there a way in which, well, first of all, I look at the scenario in the dream. Okay, is this a one army versus another army? Is it me versus a mob? You know, what's the numbers? What are the numbers on both sides? And what am I escaping from? If it is an escape dream, you know, if it's two armies meeting on the battlefield and they're relatively well matched, I would be inclined to look at places where I'm of two minds about something.
That was the voice of my guest, Ann Hill. Ann Hill is a writer, dream consultant, and public speaker based in Northern California. She has a private dream practice and teaches internationally on dreams and spirituality. Her website is www.annhill.org, and Ann is spelled A-N-N-E. Ann is also the host of Dream Talk Radio, airing every Thursday morning from 9 to 10 on KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. The show can also be heard streaming on the web at www.kows.fm. Ann writes for the Huffington Post on dreams and culture, and also writes the award-winning blog O-Gnosis. She is co-author with Starhawk of Circle Round, Raising Children in Goddess Traditions, and her work has been published in many anthologies and periodicals. Now, here's the interview. Ann Hill, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
For a number of years, I've been teaching a course at Sonoma State University called Myth, Dream, and Symbol. So I was particularly interested to discover another dream worker local to me here in Sonoma County.
That's right.
Okay. Well, maybe you can tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be involved in dream work.
Sure. Well, I guess as most dream workers will tell you, the call came through dreams. I'm one of those people who has a long shelf full of journals extending back to when I was a kid, and I've always paid attention to dreams. And about 16 years ago, some friends and I, who were in a book group together, we read Jeremy Taylor's book, When People Fly and Water Runs Uphill, and we decided, and that book is all about forming dream groups. And so we decided, well, let's give it a try. It sounds like an interesting process. So we started our own dream group out of it, knowing very little about how to interpret dreams or how to look at dreams in various ways to get insight from them. But to make a long story short, we are still meeting together every week after 16 years.
Wow.
And four of us are the original, some of the original members. So it's really, it has turned into an amazing source of, just insight, and it validates our experience, and it's given many of us different ideas about what we want to do with our life. Some of us have left and gone to school to change professions and so forth. And for me, it has really turned me more in the direction of dreams. So I started pursuing more studies about dreams and studied with Jeremy for a while and got a Doctor of Ministry degree, all in interfaith ministry, so that, you know, that whole idea of the myths and the collective unconscious and how it unfolds for different people in different traditions, but there's still a common language that we can use. I find that really useful in helping people with their dreams.
You know, you mentioned Jeremy Taylor, who I've also interviewed here and who's been a guest several times in my class. As a matter of fact, he was a guest just a few weeks ago. And he's a Unitarian minister, and he's kind of declared that dream work is, in fact, his ministry. So I wonder if you're doing something similar by getting that doctor of ministry.
Well, actually, yes. I mean, Jeremy has been a mentor to me and a very big influence, and he and his wife, Kathy, are just wonderful friends. And I think that I would say, I guess the difference between myself and Jeremy is I do dream work as ministry. I do dream groups in Catholic seminaries and pagan seminaries, and I talk to atheists, and so I do it in a sort of a spiritual direction focus. But I also lead seminars in sleep issues and health issues connected to sleep and dreams for a number of, corporate and medical settings and so forth. So I really kind of try to spread it around and try and communicate and translate what I know to the broadest variety of people.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I have a copy of the small book that you've written titled What to Do When Dreams Go Bad, A Practical Guide to Nightmares. What was the impetus for writing that book?
Thanks. It was a big project, but I really enjoyed it. I'm very happy with how it turned out. What led me to write it? Well, it was, as I describe in the book, I was leading a weekend workshop out of town. And I woke up in the morning, and I was going to, this was a sort of a year-long training that I was doing with some people, and this particular weekend we were going to be working with nightmare images and sort of dealing with shadow issues, because as I'm sure you know, the shadow, our shadow as Jung described it, is expressed so much in the disturbing images in our dreams. And so this was a way that we could sort of do some dream reentry and a little bit of work confronting and facing our fears and our projections that emerge in our nightmares. So we had this sort of heavy subject coming on to the weekend, and I woke up the first morning of the workshop at bolt out of bed with a nightmare. And I thought, well, this, if nothing else, this is very good timing. So the nightmare, working on the nightmare, sort of led me to realize that I actually had something to say about nightmares and that I wanted to put it in book form.
You know, I think nightmares are one of the first topics that come up whenever we're talking or presenting about dreams, because I think everybody's had them at one time or another. This nightmare that you had that sort of was the stimulus for writing the book, is that a nightmare that you'd feel comfortable sharing with us now?
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, it was a very brief dream, and it came right before I woke up in the morning. And so I can say one thing that distinguishes nightmares from night terrors, for instance. Night terrors tend to wake us up more in the beginning of the night or in the middle of the night. And often in night terrors, we don't really remember our dreams so much. We just wake up, sweating or heart pounding, that sort of thing. Nightmares, on the other hand, tend to occur later on in the night. And there's a narrative, there's a dream narrative more readily attached to it. So anyway, this was early in the morning. This was actually about an hour before I had to wake up. And I dreamt that I was lying on either a chaise lounge or on the grass or on the beach in the sun, just soaking in the sun. I was lying on my stomach, so my back was, I was just feeling warm and content, that wonderful feeling when you're just resting and relaxing and you've got the sun on your skin. And then suddenly, to my left, a friend yells, "Anne, watch out!" And I leap forward. I sort of raise my head, and there's a man standing in front of me, enormous guy, huge, tree trunk size person, and I can't see his face, but he's so close to where I'm sitting that I think I'm in danger, you know. So I leap to my feet and I sort of get in an Aikido stance, a sort of a ready stance, because, you know, I've trained in martial arts. So even in my dreams, the physical training bleeds through into my dreams. So there I am in a split second facing this person, but at the same time, I had been sleeping actually on my stomach, and the dream, the shock of being called out in a warning made me leap out of bed, and I turned around and I was sitting up before I knew it in this instant, and I woke up and I was sitting up after this strange, very brief, but very intense dream, and I thought, what on earth was that? I don't know. So my work with the dream led me into really looking at this figure, which was quite vague, actually. I mean, it was male, it was large, but I couldn't see the face. And so I didn't know the ethnicity, I didn't know the age, I didn't know anything about this person. And so my work with the dream involved doing a lot of the concepts that I talk about in terms of how people can use nightmares to further their own insight and their own growth.
Can you say, I don't know if it's too personal for you to share here or not, but can you tell us a little bit about the work that came out of that dream, you know, what you discovered?
Sure. Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, I had woken up, and this was the morning where I was going to lead a group of people into a sort of a meditative state, and where we bring up an image that's a disturbing image from dreams, and through a very slow and calming meditation are able to engage in dialogue and have some sort of exchange with that figure and learn something about why this figure has such a charge. So I woke up and I thought, well, okay, this is really good timing, and now I have something to work with. And how interesting that a nightmare should come to me at the very beginning of working on nightmares. So while I was leading this meditation for the group, I was doing my own work with this dream image. And one thing that I noticed was that in the dream, my friend called out. I didn't know who it was, but there seemed to be a group of friends over in one corner of this outside spot that we were at. And my sense on rising up to meet this intruder was that he was probably going to be stronger than me if he was about to attack me. He was going to be stronger, but I could probably hold him off for long enough for my friends to come racing in to help. So I was doing all of this strategizing in that split second in the dream. And so my martial arts skills came in handy. And also, I think the good news in the dream was that I had friends who were on my side, who could, you know, back me up, and they had my back in some way, actually kind of literally, because I was, you know, they saw the person before I did. Now, the other thing that I noticed is that my immediate assumption, and I think it was a good one in the dream, is that this is a dangerous situation. I am extremely vulnerable. I can't even see this guy. He's very close. I need to move into a better position. So using the assumption that this person meant me harm, I rose up and looked at him. And so when I went into a meditation and really focused on what I could remember, any of the detail about this person, I realized that although it was a good thing that I had the immediate assumption and the immediate, self-preservation instinct to rise up and prepare to, you know, to engage with this person, nothing in this person per se seemed like it was causing me harm. I didn't see a weapon in any hand. I couldn't see the face, so I couldn't see if, you know, this guy had a scowl on his face or if he was, you know, high on some kind of weird drugs or what, but there was no weapon. His fists weren't clenched. His body actually seemed kind of relaxed. So, and he was wearing just sort of normal clothes, jeans and a button-down shirt. So in the meditation, I realized, well, isn't this interesting how images from our nightmares, which are so scary at first, when we are able to to re-examine them without the emotional content of fear that's attached to the nightmare, how their whole presentation can shift and we can actually see different things about them. I mean, so I began to reimagine this encounter, that this there was a presence that was very close and it was startling, and I had to pay attention to it, but it was not something necessarily that was going to be harmful to me. It's something that was just instantaneous and that I needed to pay attention to. So it really did shift my whole perception of the dream.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned that you were about to give a presentation to a group, I think you said to a new group, and so I'm just wondering, did you have any sense that this nightmare was somehow expressing maybe fear or anticipation of, you know, of that presentation, maybe concern about other people's judgments? That's probably what it would be for me. I don't know if that would fit for you or
about
not.
About people's judgments.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing was I sensed a lot of trepidation in the group. People were really nervous. I mean, they were willing to sort of go on faith that, yeah, there was something reasonable in working with nightmares, but there was a lot of nervousness. And I couldn't really attach the nightmare to anything specific. That's an interesting idea about people's perceptions, about the figure being attached to perceptions. But what the dream did allow me to do was pay greater attention. I mean, the whole message of the dream seemed to be to pay attention. Like, I really need to stay focused on something.
Yes.
And so I did that. In, you know, the whole day I was listening very carefully to people and asking questions and making sure that, you know, everybody was with me every step of the way. And I have to say, David, it was pretty amazing. At the end of that 2-day workshop, the energy of the group had completely shifted. There was this huge relief. People had just been amazed by what they'd found in their nightmares and, you know, disturbing images. And so the whole thing was quite transformative.
Well, that's wonderful. So what's your overall take on why we have nightmares? You have a kind of generalized theory?
Well, I do. I mean, it's a little bit hard to generalize completely because I know that nightmares come for a lot of different reasons. For instance, my daughter, who had just been sick a couple days ago, and she said she had a zombie dream, and so she knew she was sick because every time she gets sick and has a fever, she always has a zombie dream. So, you know, I think it's important to point out that there are physical things that happen that cause nightmares, for instance, fevers and sickness. So I'm you know, willing to sort of treat that, the organic and physiological stuff slightly differently.
Sure.
Although I think we can still work with those nightmares and get a lot out of them. But I would have to agree with Jeremy that nightmares seem, in my experience, to come from It's a dream turns into a nightmare when it's an extremely urgent message. And I'm sure you know from your years of dream work how, you know, every dream, even the smallest little dreams, seem to have some new information for us, some new news about our lives or about how we're thinking about things. And nightmares really seem to pack a punch. They're urgent. They get us to remember them. And sometimes they keep us in their grip for days or months even. So I think there's a sense of urgency about them, and I've never encountered a nightmare that hasn't been, when it's unpacked, that hasn't been tremendously valuable and healing, actually. So I was a skeptic at some point. I thought, well, maybe there are some types of nightmares that are just bad and you shouldn't really touch them or work with them. You should just sort of let them be. But I actually, that hasn't been my experience. There's always been good to come out of working with nightmares.
What about nightmares related to trauma? Do they represent a special case, do you think?
Yes, well, you know, that's a huge topic because there is so much trauma now. I was doing a bunch of reading as I was writing the book and read about vets from World War II, actually, were the first, I think they were the first generation of war veterans in this country who were actually helped by this desensitization process where, you know, they would have recurring dreams, nightmares about, you know, battle situations and horrific things that they'd experienced. And simply, there was this one guy, I can't remember his name offhand, but he was working with these people in a professional capacity, and he would have them repeat their dream. He would have them say the dream. And this was extremely difficult for many of the men, because who wants to remember that stuff when it's so horrific and it's so closely tied to trauma that we've experienced? But what he found was that the more that people were able to speak what they were seeing in their nightmares, the more they were able to verbalize it, even if it was the same dream night after night and it was really difficult to even face, it seemed to aid the healing process. And I've seen this play out with people who work with incest survivors and, you know, children who've suffered different kinds of abuse and neglect. And I think it's really something that we can use to help all the people, particularly who are coming back from overseas with, you know, incredible traumas and PTSD. There's this, it seems to me, a crying need for this kind of dream work with people.
Yes, I agree. So if I'm hearing you correctly, then nightmares have messages for us, and they're delivered with high emotional intensity to really make sure that we pay attention to them.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I was struck by in the book was that you have a section on nightmares and creativity. And I think most of us don't associate scary nightmares with being creative. Can they actually lead to artistic or creative productions?
Oh, absolutely. And there's so many examples. The one that's coming to my mind, of course, is Mary Shelley. I think hers is a real famous example where she and her husband were at Lord Byron's place and with a few other writers, and Lord Byron was reading a ghost story, and I guess everybody had been visiting for a while, and he said, he laid down a challenge for the group and said, well, I think everybody here should write a ghost story. And so Mary Shelley went to sleep that night and had this really amazing dream, this full of tension and horror, and basically, she dreamt about seeing Frankenstein, the monster, and she woke up from that dream, and she thought it was a eureka moment for her. She thought, I have figured out what I'm going to write, because all I need to do is simply write down what I have just experienced in my dream. And sure enough, she wrote Frankenstein, the book, and look, I mean, Frankenstein has become this incredible touchstone in our culture about sort of the evils of technology, or people's fear of technology, and the ways that modernization is changing us as humans. And it brings up all of these different issues and really encapsulates them so neatly. It's become a cultural icon. And that was all directly from her dream. And that's just one example of, you know, nightmares and creativity.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, is that another example? Do you know? It seems to come to mind.
I think Dracula actually came from that, and it may have come from that same writer's group. But yes, many, many stories. In fact, I don't know if you're going to the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference.
I'm not going to this one, probably. I was going to ask you if you were going.
I am going. In fact, I'm going with my daughter, who the conference is in Chicago, and my daughter's an art student there, and she is going to be displaying some of her artwork that's come directly from her childhood nightmares.
Oh, wonderful.
So talking about creativity and nightmares, I think it's important to say that we can all, I mean, we're not all Mary Shelley, but we can all use this rich stew of imagery and emotional content in our nightmares to create amazing things, you know, drawings and particularly narratives, people who are novelists or writers. In fact, my daughter even has a film about, she's made herself a costume out that turns her into her biggest childhood nightmare villain. It's an amazing transformation, and she's actually created a film of her walking around as Llama Man. Was her big recurrent nightmare. So,
okay, it makes me want to go to the conference to see all that. Yeah, I'm going to miss going to that conference. It's just a matter of economics, I think.
It is. Yeah. Yes.
One of the things that I think readers will love about your book is that you go through so many of the common nightmare themes that so many people have experienced. And I'd like to step through those, if you don't mind. So what about dreams of showing up naked in public? I know I've had that dream, and probably some of our listeners have as well.
That's a big one. That's a very common nightmare theme. I was talking to a friend of mine who had the same dream a while ago, and I mean, I guess for me, when I approach people's nightmares, or really any type of dream, but particularly these nightmares that are so archetypal, you know, showing up naked in public, and there's the humiliation and the embarrassment and the completely inappropriate nature of what we find ourselves doing in dreams, the first thing I do is go to the most common associations. And, you know, often, most of the time, somebody will have an aha. They will have an insight from those common ones. But if that's not quite, it doesn't quite hit the mark, or they still don't understand the dream, then you can go into all the little details. So what I try to do in the book is hit those major themes that people seem to associate with different nightmares scenarios. So for being naked in public, the biggest thing that I see in those dreams is the fear of self-revealment. Either I'm revealing too much of myself and it's making me uncomfortable, or people want me to reveal more of myself and that's making me uncomfortable. And so there's ways in which we find ourselves in social situations and maybe we're getting feedback. We're being too authentic or too honest. You know, there's all these ways in which we need to be diplomatic in work situations, or in this particular friend's instance, he was at church. He was at church and he was naked in church, and so that sort of brought up his whole community of you know, this whole religious community, and how how he was being perceived in that group, or how he was afraid of being perceived in that group.
So that's interesting that there's that sort of universal component. Yes. of fear of exposure, but also a personal spin on it that it had a certain meaning in the context of his life that only he could know about or
that's
make
right.
that association.
Yes, I think that's generally true about dreams. You know, it's sort of like the common associations are like the freeway. So you can go on the freeway so far, but then you have to go on to get off on an exit and go on, you know, your own particular direction with the dream symbol.
Yeah, I'm hesitating at revealing too much right now myself, but that dream of being naked, I've realized actually has. I think it might be, for me, rooted in a childhood experience where, as a little guy, I think I had soiled myself past the point where my mother thought that kind of thing should be going on. And she forced me to go outside in diapers. And I was at an age where that was really not appropriate. And it was a humiliating, awful experience that I still remember.
Oh, that sounds awful. It sounds abusive by today's standards.
Yeah, I think so. There are a couple other things she did, I think, that would be abusive by today's standards.
Well, and that points out another issue with the being naked in public dreams, which is vulnerability. And I think that's largely why we see adolescents and little kids with the highest frequency of nightmares, because they're always conscious of the fact that they're small and vulnerable. You know, they need adults to take care of them. And when we have dreams about being naked in public, we are so vulnerable. And it's, you know, it's extremely uncomfortable as adults to be reminded of the fact that sometimes we just really, we don't have it all together. And we hit upon these moments where all of our childhood vulnerability comes up again.
Yes.
In a big way.
That's a good point, that yeah. we're small and vulnerable
yes.
For the early part of our life, and some part of that evidently doesn't go away. Maybe closely related are dreams of being unprepared for a test. I know I've had nightmares where they're passing out the tests, the exams, but they're doing it really slowly. And by the time they come to me, the time's almost over, and then my pencil breaks.
Oh, you know. Don't you hate those dreams?
Yeah. what are those about?
And I think it's always interesting to notice what class it is. I mean, like, is this a high school dream or a middle school or a college? Because, I mean, it seems to me, again, going back to the childhood theme of vulnerability, I mean, those whole first years, I would say up until adolescence, so probably through about eighth or ninth grade, we're really, I mean, the subtext of everything we're doing is that we're learning how to be ourselves, but also how to function in the structures of society around us. And so I think, you know, when I find myself back in the halls of my junior high school, God forbid, you know, there's always some way that I'm feeling like, did I get it right? It's similar to the naked in public dreams. Did I get it right? Did I just have a big gaffe? Did I not understand the social context in which I was just having an encounter with somebody? Do you know what I mean? There's all
yes.
these, and they really hit these core issues that from childhood we're trying to figure out how this works.
Well, and also we all have had the experience, I think, of considerable anxiety around tests. I mean, we come up through years and years of schooling in which there were tests, and whether we did badly or even if we didn't do badly, sometimes it's the people who get A's, in fact, who are the most anxious about their performance.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's an incredible amount of stress involved and self-control point where it's too much when we're trying to succeed all the time.
There was an article in Time magazine years ago or a study that they reported. I'm not sure which it was, but what they found out was that lots and lots of high achieving adults, you know, who are well established in their professional lives are still having these dreams, these test anxiety dreams.
Well, and it really makes you wonder what makes people go for the high achievement careers? And it's an interesting issue in itself. I work with a lot of people who have achieved great success in their field. And usually they start to really work with their dreams when they sense that, you know, maybe the wave has peaked and maybe they've learned what they needed to learn by being in the fast lane and, you know, being the real type A personality. And they're ready to experience what lies in the still place. You know, what happens if you take your foot off the gas pedal? And so a lot of times those people will have dreams about, you know, the car going off the cliff or these fears of basically what happens when we take our foot off the gas pedal. Does everything fall apart or is there some sort of soft landing that we can imagine or some other force that comes through in it and makes it so that our lives are not, we don't have to exert ourselves so much to have a productive life.
I'm vibrating to all of these themes. So I have all kinds of dreams where the car goes off the road and so on. And I retired recently. Maybe it's got something to do with that.
Well, that's another point where people have to, I mean, any time really that we're making a major life change, you know, the kids are moving out of the house. Okay, what's life like without kids? Or, you know, the divorce comes through. Okay, what's life like as a single person? Retirement, career change. These are all major points at which nightmares can surface, and also a lot of anxiety dreams can surface.
Yeah, you know, closely related to the test anxiety dream, I've had my own variant of that, which I think is quite similar, which is a teaching anxiety dreams. And those, oh, I hate those. And they typically would happen towards the end of the summer when the next semester is coming up. And I will be leading a group or trying to teach a class, and maybe the people are bored, or they're talking and I can't get control, or I have nothing to say, I haven't prepared, and just I get flooded with anxiety. And the irony is, once I'm in the classroom, I'm master of my domain.
Yes. Isn't that funny? And it reminds me of Arthur Rubinstein, the famous pianist. And he was in his 90s. He was performing well into his 90s, maybe even past the age of 100. But in his 90s, somebody asked him if he still got nervous before concerts. And he said, "My dear, if I didn't get nervous before concerts, I would think something was wrong." This is a guy in his 90s. What does he have to prove to anybody? Nothing.
Right.
But I think to some extent, those anxiety dreams before the semester starts, I mean, you wake up from those things and feel like kicking yourself, like, can I drop it with the anxiety already? You know, this has been 40 years I've been doing this. But I think in part it's just also a picture of us marshaling our energy. You know, it's a reminder that I'm my creative juices are flowing, and I'm starting the process already of teaching this class. So
yeah.
That, you know, it comes through in an anxiety dream.
Well, that's a good point. And I think I'm happy to say, I think I have made some progress in with those dreams. In fact, becoming a bit more lucid someplace in the dream.
Oh,
and
yes.
Just being able to say, hey, this is a dream and don't go there.
Right. That's nice when we can shift the story like that. Boy,
yeah.
What a relief that is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. What about dreams of war or violent conflict?
Wow. Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big, well, I guess they're all big subjects. I was talking to another friend a couple months ago, and she said she always has dreams about the fascist dictatorship and,
yeah.
You know, the uprising. There's always a us versus them thing. And I think, you know, us versus them is a really interesting theme to look at in dreams, because it can be a picture of our own warring impulses. I mean, I guess that's where I go first. Is there a way in which, first of all, I look at the scenario in the dream. Okay, is this a one army versus another army? Is it me versus a mob? You know, what's the numbers? What are the numbers on both sides? And what am I escaping from? If it is an escape dream, you know, if it's two armies meeting on the battlefield and they're relatively well matched, I would be inclined to look at places where I'm of two minds about something, and it's a battlefield, so it's you know, nation against nation, and so it would be for me, it would be some major issue. For instance, maybe in my career, I'm thinking about, well, I just need to be creative and write. But part of me is saying, no, I need to be out there, you know, putting out flyers and getting dream groups together and blah, blah, blah. So there's these two different, you know, not that either one is incorrect, but it's a picture of my internal process, and both sides are pretty well matched, and so no victor has really come forward. So it could be an internal thing. On the other hand, it's often representative of situations at work for people. If they're in a work situation that's conflicted, or maybe there's some subterfuge going on, and that'll emerge in the dream as sort of a spy versus spy kind of a thing, or you never quite know who's on your side type of thing. It could be family situations. Sometimes when there's huge conflict in families, it'll come up. In terms of a split in values, you know, there's the good guys and the bad guys fighting it out. So lots of different ways to look at those, but I think you can go both with an internal focus and also, you look at, you know, people's daily lives and what is full of strife, what strife has emerged in our lives.
Those are great suggestions. And I guess part of the message is to really ask oneself, well, what's going on? What's going on in my life? And how might this dream be a metaphor for what's going on? One of the another topic that you write about is death dreams. I don't have the impression that we often dream of our own death, but I think often people dream that somebody else dies, and sometimes they get worried, you know, like somebody dreams that their mother died and they're worried that, oh, is it going to happen, or does that mean I'm wishing something negative on my mother?
Right. Oh, boy. And you start spinning into guilt as soon as you wake up from those dreams.
Mm.
Oh, no. Is Freud right? Is this really an image of wish fulfillment here?
Right. You know?
Yeah, those are very tough dreams to wake up from. In fact, I was just talking with somebody yesterday who had a dream that somebody whispered in his ear, "Your mother is dead."
Oh.
He woke up from that and instantly called. I mean, yeah. I think the instant reaction, and sometimes people feel awkward about this or embarrassed about it, is to actually check in with the person. How are you doing? How are you doing? Are you okay with this? Or is anything going on? And sometimes people actually do have dreams of that, prescient dreams that somebody's in danger, or particularly with sick relatives, they'll have visitation dreams where the person comes to say goodbye and they'll call in the morning after waking up, and sure enough, they've just passed away the night before. So that's, you know, I always encourage people to attend to the literal, you know, assume that there might be some literal truth in this dream, and always check it out. Always go look at the safety issues involved. Check in with people, see how they're doing. Not that you call them up and say, "Oh my God, I just dreamt that you were brutally murdered." I mean, that's not really helpful.
No.
But you can say, "How are you doing? I had a dream that made me worry about you. You know, is everything okay?" And then, of course, if everything's fine, you think, okay, well, the dream wasn't coming to tell me something that's an immediate literal threat. So this must be something that I work with in a metaphoric way. So if it's my mother has died is the message of the dream, let's think about ways in which I've internalized my mother, or my ideas of nurturing maybe have taken a radical shift, or what I'm looking for in my life that will nurture me is really shifted, and so on and so forth.
Well, you have lots more specific dreams that you cover, but I don't want to give the whole book away here.
So,
we have to leave people a reason to go out and get it. You have a section called A Nightmare Survival Kit. What are your recommendations in that regard?
Right. Well, the first thing is when you wake up from a scary dream, do not... Okay, let me back up a little bit. I think probably one of the first nightmares I remember was I was a college student. I was young, and I woke up, and I had this roommate that I really did not like at all. We did not get along, but it was one of those unfortunate things where you have to just coexist for at least a semester. And I woke up, and I was literally shaking. I was petrified, and I was sure that, you know, she had done something to me, that I was being zapped in some sort of psychic way. And it took all of my willpower, honestly, not to go and shake her and yell at her. So my first suggestion for the Nightmare Survival Kit is, whatever you do, don't make things worse. You know, don't assume that somebody was actually trying to hex you. Don't send out defamatory emails to people. Don't make the situation worse. And what you do need to do is calm yourself and recenter yourself. And so I go into a lot of ideas for, you know, taking a drink of water, writing down the dream, lighting a candle, bringing some light in, and maybe having a little bit of a sip of tea or a warm bath, anything to calm yourself down. And, of course, if you've had a dream about an intruder in your house, you know, it's when you feel like you're ready to actually be present with what is, what really is at this very moment, then you go around and you know, check the doors and locks. And if you've dreamt about your puppy being trapped in a corner, go see about how the puppy's doing. I always recommend to people, if they've dreamt about something harming their children, go check that they're okay, but don't wake them up. They don't really, you just want your children to sleep through the night. You don't need to wake them up and tell them your dream. And so, you know, you attend to the physical, aspects of the dream, and you calm yourself down, and if possible, you go back to sleep. If not possible, you have a little bit of something to eat, and you write about the dream, and see what you can remember of all the details, sort of like I did with my intruder dream. I wrote down every single detail I could remember. All of that's going to be useful in working with the dream in the coming days. And you can, telling a dream is very important. If you have somebody to speak the dream to, sometimes that will really take away the charge, the emotional charge of the dream, and help you get back to sleep or help you calm down. And then, of course, there's all the symbolic ways that we can work with the dream. We can bring it to a dream group, or we can talk to somebody about some of the issues that might be involved. We can look in books and take a long-term perspective. The thing about nightmares is that we're so in the moment and we're so locked into the fear or the terror that it's hard to separate out. So when you're going from working with the literal presentation of the dream into a more symbolic presentation of the dream, you really do need to be able to step back, disengage from that immediate emotional content, and look at every symbol of the dream. And so then there's always the last thing is to respond to the dream in some way, whether it is putting a little, a little talisman outside your front door, maybe a little dream catcher by the window, something to signal to your deep unconscious that you've paid attention to the dream and you're listening. You're listening and you're attuned to whatever messages would come through. So that's kind of the nutshell version, but there's a lot in each of those steps that people can really get down and into the details of their dreams with.
Wonderful. You mentioned children in passing, and that jogged my memory that I had really intended to focus on that in this discussion.
Right.
And then I had told you I was going to be focusing on that, and then I totally forgot my own instructions. So we shouldn't leave this without having you comment on children's dreams. Because I'm sure there are parents out there who are listening and who wonder, well, what do I do with my child's nightmares?
Right. And it's so important as a parent to know what to do, because partly when we're listening to our child relay a nightmare, we're kind of going through the guilt thing of, oh my God, am I doing something wrong that my child is having this dream? Let's see. I actually have, a story to tell about this. It happened to me with my youngest daughter, and it sort of encapsulates all the different ways that adults can work with children and their nightmares. So I think I've got a few minutes left. So,
oh sure,
if you don't mind, I'll go into this story. This is absolutely true. This happened exactly this way, and it's anyway. Okay, so my daughter is 2.5. My youngest daughter, and I have two older children, and she comes out of her bedroom one morning, face, you know, contorted with fear and lit up with some anguish, and she jumps into my lap in the kitchen, and she's shaking and shivering, and she said, "Monster, eat me! Monster tried to kill me!" And I think, oh no, she's had a nightmare, or maybe she hasn't had a nightmare, and because she's only 2.5, and the you don't really quite know the boundary between sleep and waking at 2.5. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm going to treat this as though it were a nightmare. So I'm saying, oh, that's terrible. And so I'm comforting her, and I'm listening, and I'm saying, you know, what the nightmare mean? And she just is not really having much of a response. But so that's the first thing the parents do, you know, the first thing to do is just to comfort your child. This is, you're safe now, right? You're safe now. It's okay. So I spent some time with her that morning, like, oh, it's okay. Well, you know, I'm right here. You're okay. And after a while, she got off my lap and just went about her day. The next morning, same thing. She comes out of her room, jumps onto my lap, shaking in fear. Monster, kill me. Monster, try and eat me. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I guess the comforting didn't quite work. We'll, you know, we'll go on to phase two of the nightmare program. And so this time I said, oh, no, that bad monster, we'll, you know, we have to, let's get your big stuffed animal and, you know, put it right next to your bed. So next time that monster comes, the bear will just, you know, kill the monster and it won't hurt you. And so trying all of these ways, these suggestions for, you know, this my daughter to be protected in sleep. And she kind of looked at me for a while, and I didn't really get the sense that this was what she was looking for, but she seemed to accept it all right. And so she got down off my lap and went about her day. The next day, I kid you not, same thing. Coming out screaming from her bedroom, monster, kill me, monster, try and eat me. And by this time, I was kind of running out of ideas, you know. And so my kids jumped into the act, and they said, oh, you just tell that monster, here, you just, you know, have a sword in your hand and tell that monster to go away and say that your big brother's going to come in and, you know, so they were giving her all these ways to re-script the dream so that there's reminding her that she has allies, that if she can, when she's in the dream, she can change the action, make something different happen. And this is actually a great way to work with older kids with nightmares. You can sort of sit down and say, okay, what do you want to have happen next time this dream happens? You know, helping them become powerful in their own dreams. So this is what we were trying in our way with this little 2.5-year-old who's, you know, still not quite satisfied with our response to this dream. So the fourth day, she comes out again. Monster, kill me. Monster, try and eat me. Jumps on my lap. And I'm completely out of ideas, David. I have no idea what to do for this child. I'm just, and as it so happens, I was in a dream group. I was in my dream group at that time. And the only thing I could think of was how we were really trying the idea that death in dreams doesn't necessarily mean literal death, that somehow death is indicative of transformation. And I would never have wanted to approach my daughter's dream in that way, thinking, okay, well, you know, the death of a child in a dream is good. I couldn't bring my mind to, but I was out of ideas. I couldn't think of anything else to tell her. So she said this whole thing, monster, kill me, monster, try and eat me. And so what I did was I stayed calm. I didn't have a reaction, and I sort of let there be a little silence, and then I said to her, and then what happened? And she gave me this surprised look, like, you mean you're not going to jump to my rescue and try all these things like you've been trying the last 3 days? She gave me this surprised look, and then she said, monster, brush my hair. Monster, have a tea party. And, and for once, she got it. That was good for her. That was a good response, that I wasn't trying to protect her from her dream, but that I was really curious as to what happened next. And I tell you, that floored me. That completely floored me. She ended up laughing at the silly monster, and we all were sort of relieved and laughing at the same time, and she never came. That was it. That was the end of that whole sequence.
That's fun. Fascinating story. So it may be that what you were trying earlier was working, but you didn't take it to that next step to know that maybe in part she was running in excitement rather than terror.
Maybe. Yeah, it was really, there was a lot of stuff going on, and my response, of course, you know, I couldn't not be the concerned mother, but once I was able to drop that and just listen to her and ask her more about the story, the whole dynamic shifted, so.
It's been delightful speaking to you, Anne. You're very, very well spoken on this topic, and you're fun to speak with. I wonder if there's anything that I haven't asked you that you maybe wanted to say.
Well, I guess the question that people often ask about nightmares is how can we make them go away? And I think my experience is that we can certainly reduce their frequency, and nightmares that are connected with trauma, we definitely want to change and shift and turn them into something different over time. But I guess because nightmares have such a creative impulse in them and there's so many riches to be found in them, I'm not convinced that we want to vanquish nightmares. I think we actually really want to engage with all that shadow material and, you know, keep a curious attitude and see what's there for us.
Well, that's a wonderful place for us to close. Anne Hill, thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Anne Hill and perhaps have gained some new perspective on nightmares. One of the earliest dreams I can remember from childhood is a nightmare in which I become aware that there is a leg of a sleeping man in my bed. At first, I think maybe it's my father or some other family member. I lay there stewing over it and getting more and more frightened. I think I must have felt the leg with my foot, and I think maybe it is a very hairy leg. Finally, I summon up my courage and give it a sound kick while simultaneously screaming for my parents. Of course, they come rushing into my room, my dad included. There's no man's leg in the bed. I make them look in the closet and under the bed. It seemed so real that it was very hard for me to dismiss it as a mere dream. It's interesting that the dream was so powerful that it's still with me today. What sense can I make of that dream today? Of course, I don't have much recollection of exactly what was going on at that point in my life. I'm not sure how old I would have been, perhaps somewhere between 5 and 7 years. Although I've been in various dream groups over the years, and I'm even in one now, I've never shared this dream or tried to work on it. How might the dream have been processing my situation at that time, and perhaps even preparing me for my life to come? Some perhaps not so random thoughts and associations come to mind. It was sort of a disembodied leg, as I recall. I didn't have a sense of the whole person, just the leg. But it was a hairy leg. I thought it might be my dad, but my dad, in this case, was actually my stepfather, and being of African-American and Native American descent, he was free of body hair. My biological father, on the other hand, probably had very hairy legs, as I was destined to have as I grew up. In my teen years, in fact, I was very embarrassed to have such hairy legs. My younger sister would tease me mercilessly about them, and I was afraid no woman would ever find me attractive because of my hairy legs. I'm happy to report that I was later to discover it was quite the opposite. At the age when I had the nightmare, though, I don't think I would have had any conscious knowledge of my biological father, never having lived with him. Yet the missing father has been a major theme of my adult life. I was finally able to find him and met him in my early 30s through a chain of fairly miraculous synchronicities. And then, after a bit, I let that relationship drop. Too much water had gone under the bridge to build a relationship at that point, or so I thought. Now, nearly 30 years later, I'm just recently building new bridges to that side of the family, even though my biological father, unfortunately, has passed on. By not growing up with that side of the family, I missed out on a very rich cultural and artistic heritage, so there's some sense of loss there for me. On the other hand, I would not be who I am today had I not traveled my own unique path. So it may be a stretch, but I think my hairy leg nightmare of childhood may have in some way presaged my dance with the missing father and the father archetype.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey, here's a question for you. What do you think about the idea of psychologists being able to prescribe medications? Maybe you've never thought about it, but that's the direction some psychologists have been pursuing. To find out more about that issue, you'll want to hear my interview with William Robiner, Ph.D., on prescription privileges for psychologists. You'll find that on my other podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. And do remember to tell your friends, colleagues, and family and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, Twitter, so on. I seem to be gathering more friends on Twitter, and you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. We have no new additions to our Frapper map. If you're not on there, please add yourself. You'll find a link on our site, or you can simply go to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio and let us know where in the world you are. Shrink Wrap Radio is part of the ProMed Network and also sciencepodcasters.org. And by the way, if you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, costs you nothing to do so. It just means the episodes get automatically delivered to you. And it does help me to know the size of my audience. And the easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes. And also, there is a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand gutter area of the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And speaking of iTunes, if you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. It helps keep us on the front page of their higher education shows. I did see that some of you have posted reviews recently, almost universally positive. There was one, I think, from a psych professor somewhere that was very critical. I think he listened to one of our left-of-center shows and felt that I wasn't nearly a critical enough thinker and had not challenged my guest. So he gave me only one star, but I will continue to cover a broad range of content within the broad world of psychology. And please make a donation if you haven't done so. It really helps to support the show, as does your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals. So you'll find a big green donate button on our site along with links to these sponsors.
Dr. Dave, we thank you for your humanistic, transpersonal, and existential approach to psychology. Congratulations on your awesome podcast.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Michael Nistler here. As my robotic friend said, kudos to you, and please keep those podcasts coming. We're all crazy about you.
You know, I get bad allergies this time of year, so you may hear me sniffing or my voice may sound strange. But let's check into some recent emails from our listener community. Before I read the emails, I want to again call your attention to the work that Reinhard from Austria has been doing, adding book suggestions to the comments area of many past shows. So thanks, Reinhard, and keep up your good work. So first we hear from Mark, who writes, Dr. Dave, fantastic show with Dr. Radin. This one hit the spot. I subscribe to about a dozen podcasts, and when they pile up, I start with the most interesting and work my way down. As I was sorting through my podcasts, I ran across your interview with Dr. Radin and immediately started listening. This is exactly the field of study I was hoping for as I progressed through my university psychology program. Of course, Dr. Radin echoed exactly my experience of being shunned and laughed at for such ideas. I was also pleasantly surprised by the synchronicity of Dr. Radin working in the telecommunications industry and studying parapsychology purely as an intellectual interest. This is exactly my story, but I ended up staying in telecommunications. Dr. Dave, we also share, quotes, the knack, and he's referring to, I said that I felt I had psychic ability with machines, that I can kind of see into them and quickly figure out what's wrong and repair them. And so he writes, Dr. Dave, we also share the knack. In a Dilbert cartoon, Dilbert's mother was having problems with her TV remote. Without looking, Dilbert told her to swap out the third battery from the left. Of course, it worked. He called this ability the knack. That's great to know. He goes on to say, I work in a telecommunications lab for government projects. These are state-of-the-art labs developing some serious hardware. I'm the guy who gets the job of training the newbies. I find it difficult to explain my ability to, quotes, just know the problems during troubleshooting. It's very zen-like, and I can usually walk into a room, know where the problem is, and fix it within seconds. It's very odd, and many people have commented on this feat. I'm certain many constructs are in play, i.e. confidence, experience, knowledge, etc., but a lot of the time something just clicks, and I can't explain it. Hey, if Dr. Radin ever needs a unique test subject, let me know. About twice a month, I fly on test aircraft, sitting in the back, totally isolated from the rest of the world. I have no Windows, no phone, no MySpace, nada. Nothing gets in and nothing gets out at 40,000 feet. I just sit there and babysit my data logging. Quite boring. If he ever needs me to focus on or guess some random event, I'm all for it. Take care, Mark. Hey, Mark, it was great hearing about the knack. So now I know it's real. And we got quite a few responses on the site to the Dean Radin interview, some very critical and some enthusiastic, such as Mark's. Listener Tom Carroll, who recommended the interview with Dean Radin, also comments on that episode, saying, David, I think you did an incredible job. I left a comment on your blog. I've listened to the show 3 times. Also went back and re-listened to show number 30. What a fantastic combo of shows. Thanks for all your work on these shows, David. You're making all of our lives a little bit better. I got a good documentary to recommend to you if you haven't already seen it. A Man Named Pearl. Pearl's Garden reminds me of Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks for being our psychological mentor, Tom. And I still need to look at A Man Named Pearl. I remember it came through our art theater, but I didn't see it. And so I should order it on Netflix. I'll bet it's available there by now. And episode number 30 that he referred to, I haven't looked it up, but I have a hunch that it's my interview with Stanley Krippner, who did a lot of work on parapsychology. Next, we hear from... Well, let me just give a little background. One of the things I had planned to mention during our show celebrating the 200th episode of Shrink Wrap Radio is the ongoing interest expressed by Adam Benatovich, who is a learning and development manager for Technip, a French petrochemical company located in Abu Dhabi. And Adam is responsible for the human relations training of some 1,500 managers throughout the company. And he regards Shrink Wrap Radio as a key component of their training. In a recent email, among other things, Adam wrote, Shrink Wrap Radio is a Technip learning partner. We are integrating your content into our training and also into our learning design philosophy. Adam. So, of course, that means a lot to me. I'm really, really pleased with the communications that I've had with Adam and with his enthusiasm for the material here. I recently heard from Debbie, who's been in several workshops that I co-led with Dr. Ron Alexander. We did a workshop at Esalen. She was also in our workshop in Switzerland and maybe even in one that we did in Mallorca. At any rate, Debbie wrote saying, Hi, David. I really appreciate your shows online. You're giving a wonderful service to the public. I always feel like I've been given a gift after listening to your show. I've submitted your site to stumble upon. I listened to your interview with Dean Radin and then read for hours all about research on Psi. I found this good site on Tarot. Since there are so many to sift through, I thought you might be interested. And she refers me to www.gaiantarot.com. And then there's /links.html. I had done work with the Tarot in the groups that I led, and so she knew of my interest. She says, I hope you're very well and that I'm able to take a class with you again someday. Most sincerely, Debbie. Debbie, as always, it's great to hear from you. Let me remind you that you can save on all your domain needs by using our discount codes at GoDaddy.com. For example, using Shrink1 at checkout will give you 10% off any order. Using Shrink2 at checkout will get you 20% off any order of $50 or more. And Shrink3 lets you buy .com domain names for only $7.49. Now, these GoDaddy discount codes are each designed to save you money based on what you want to buy or the amount you want to spend and save. Each discount code can be used over and over again, so you can keep on saving. Simply use Shrink1, Shrink2, or Shrink3 at checkout, depending upon which will save you the most money. Or go to the GoDaddy link at shrinkwrapradio.com for more information on our money-saving offers at GoDaddy.com. I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can use the My Chingo button that's on our site. Or you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Ann Hill, for her practical tips on dealing with nightmares. And next week's guest will be Dr. David Burns, a Stanford psychiatrist who will be talking about dealing with difficult relationships. He's author of 10 books. He's one of those academic heavy hitters that you won't want to miss. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.